reveal little of her true thoughts and feelings, so she rarely came across as the warm, open, genuine person she wanted to be. Another important value for Cleo was courage. She realized that each time she avoided a social event, she was acting inconsistently with this value. Clarifying these core values was an important step for Cleo. It not only laid the foundation for setting goals, as you'll see shortly, it also provided ongoing inspiration for the journey ahead. I invite you now to draw on what you've just discovered, in addition to the top six values list from Chapter 11, to complete the values window. I call this form a window because it gives you a lookout into the life you want. And as usual, if you're totally unwilling to write your answers down, then please at least think about them. And if you don't want to write in the book, you can copy the form out or download a copy from the free resources page at www.thehappinesstrap.com. In the values window, there are four frames corresponding to the major life domains of love, work, play, and health. In each frame, please clarify your values, then your goals. Short-term goals are things you'd like to achieve in the next few days and weeks. Medium-term goals are things you'd like to achieve in the next few weeks and months. Long-term goals are things you'd like to achieve over months and years. Make sure your goals are specific rather than vague and fuzzy. Here's an example of a specific goal. On Thursday night, I will sit at my computer from 8 to 11 p.m. and draw up the first draft of a business plan. Here's an example of a vague and fuzzy goal. I'll think some more about my business ideas. Here is another example, just to be clear. Specific. On Sunday night after dinner, I will spend an hour practicing my talk for the Monday morning meeting. Vague. In future, I'll practice my talks a bit more. This is an important distinction. A wealth of research shows that we are far more likely to achieve a specific, well-defined goal than a vague and fuzzy one. So using your values as a guide, please now set some specific and meaningful goals. And as you do this exercise, please notice what your mind has to say and the feelings that arise in your body. The values window. Love, deepest, most meaningful relationships, including children, partner, parents, close friends, and relatives. My values, short-term goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. Work. Paid work, studying, education, apprenticeships, and unpaid work such as volunteering or domestic duties. My values, short-term goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. Play, rest and relaxation, hobbies, creativity, sports, and all forms of leisure, recreation, and entertainment. My values, short-term goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. Health. Physical, psychological, emotional, or spiritual health and well-being. My values, short-term goals, medium-term goals, long-term goals. You can't do it all at once. Have you completed the values window, either mentally or on paper? If so, pause for 10 seconds and notice what your mind is saying. Is it jumping for joy or telling you it's all too hard? If your mind's anything like mine, it's doing the latter. When we start setting goals, our minds can easily get overwhelmed. I can't possibly do all these things. It's too much. Ah! So if that's what your mind is doing, please thank it and continue reading. If you want to carve a sculpture from a block of marble, you can't chip away at every part of the block simultaneously. You have to choose somewhere to start. You chip away at that area for a while, and then once you have made some progress, you move on to another part. The same holds true for shaping our lives. If we try working away at every part of them simultaneously, we'll get overwhelmed, and we'll either give up or make a mess of it. So I invite you now to read through what you've written and select just one domain of life, love, work, play, or health, and no more than two or three short-term goals. Once you've made some progress with these goals, then you can choose some others to work on, either from the same life domain or from a different one. And you can keep on doing this for the rest of your life. Naturally, at times, you'll focus more on one domain than on others, but hopefully, over time, you'll take care of them all. After filling in the values window, Cleo chose to focus first and foremost on the domain of love. Here's how it looked on her worksheet. Love. My values. To be warm, open, genuine, supportive, and authentic in my social interactions. To be more courageous and to act on what's in my heart rather than being ruled by my fear. Short-term goals. Monday morning, ask 2 co-workers that I hardly ever talk to about what they did on the weekend, and I'll tell them what I did. Medium-term goals. Join a book club, contribute more in conversations, and reveal more of my own opinions and ideas. Practice asking open-ended questions. Practice telling anecdotes. Long-term goals. To build an active social life, going out at least once a week, to make at least 2 or 3 new friends within the next year. On your own worksheet, if you've written a lot more than in the above example, that's not a problem, but if you've written a lot less, that probably indicates you need to invest a bit more time and effort. Once you've completed the exercise, contemplate your goals and notice the thoughts and feelings that show up. Do you feel any sense of fear, anxiety, trepidation, or nervousness? If so, good. You'll be needing it for the next section of the book. Part 4. Taming Your Fear. Chapter 14. The Fear Trap. At the age of 19, Albert Ellis was terrified of rejection by women. Of course, at that point in his life, Ellis had no idea that he would one day become one of the most influential psychologists of the 20th century. It didn't even figure in his wildest dreams. What he did dream about was getting over his fear. So what did he do about it? For 1 month, Ellis visited the New York Botanical Gardens every day and forced himself to talk to every attractive woman he encountered. Fearful though he was, somehow he managed to open his mouth and get the words out. And by the end of the month, he had asked over 100 women for a date. And not one single one of them said yes. But Ellis did not see this as a failure. On the contrary, he regarded it as a great success. Why? Because by this point, he had completely overcome his fear of rejection. He had learned that fear was nothing more nor less than an unpleasant feeling, that it couldn't stop him from doing what he wanted. It was a profound insight that freed him to live a lifetime of adventure. I debated whether to include this example in the book, because many women dislike being hassled in this way, and this could make Ellis sound a bit like a pickup artist. But I chose to include it anyway. I'm not advocating or condoning this behavior, merely using it as a dramatic example of someone overcoming a deeply held fear. A dangerous beast? Imagine you've grown up in a weird community and you've been taught that sheep are the most dangerous animals on the planet, that they have huge, razor-sharp teeth that can tear you to shreds, that they love nothing more than to kill and eat humans, and that they can leap higher than a 3-story house. Suppose you completely believe this, and one day you are out walking through the countryside when you suddenly catch sight of a sheep. It's staring at you from behind a small wooden fence. How would you feel? Nervous? Anxious? Terrified? This may seem like a far-fetched fantasy, but it's rather like the way we've all been raised to think about fear. From a young age, we've been educated to believe that fear is bad, that it's a sign of weakness, that it's unnatural, that successful people don't have it, that it holds us back in life, and that we need to reduce it or get rid of it. And we all too readily believe this stuff because A, the brainwashing starts when we're naive little kids, and B, fear feels so unpleasant it seems to make sense that it would be bad for us. So as a result, we have learned to fear our own fear. We have become anxious about our anxiety. We have gotten nervous about our nervousness. Spot the vicious cycle, anyone? What is fear? Consult a few dictionaries or textbooks, and you'll usually find fear defined something like this: a feeling of agitation or apprehension in response to a real or imagined threat. Throughout this book, I've been using the word fear very loosely as a catch-all phrase that covers all its relatives: anxiety, nerves, panic, stress, self-doubt, insecurity, and so on. In this section of the book, we are going to focus on the physical aspects of fear, the sensations and feelings in our bodies: sweaty hands, racing heart, jelly legs, butterflies in the stomach, lump in the throat, dry mouth, tense neck, fidgety feet, and so on. Obviously, thoughts play an important role in creating, maintaining, and exacerbating our fears, and the best way to deal with those is through diffusion. In other words, when your mind conjures up a scary thought, image, or memory, notice it, name it, and neutralize it. However, in ACT, we use a different mindfulness skill to deal with feelings and sensations in our bodies. It's called expansion, and I'm going to cover it in detail in the next two chapters. But first, let's consider how we typically react to fear. Autopilot and avoidance. Most of us aren't too good at handling painful emotions such as anger, fear, sadness, and guilt. We typically have two modes of responding to them, autopilot mode and avoidance mode. Autopilot mode. In autopilot mode, we are at the mercy of our emotions. It's as if we are robots and the emotions control our every move. Anger shows up and suddenly we are lashing out, yelling abuse or stomping our feet. Fear shows up and we run, withdraw, or hide from our challenges. When you're on automatic pilot, you are not mindful of where you are and what you are doing, and you are definitely not in touch with your values. Instead, your emotions are running the show, jerking you around as if you were a puppet on a string. Unfortunately, this creates the illusion that strong emotions are dangerous, which then feeds the myth that we can't act the way we want unless we can control the way we feel. Avoidance mode. You don't have to be a top psychologist to figure out that humans like feeling good. None of us enjoy unpleasant feelings. And let's face it, under most circumstances, fear is an unpleasant feeling. I say most circumstances because at times we may hand over good money in order to have this very feeling. For example, if we watch a scary movie, read a thriller, or take a ride on a roller coaster. Given that fear usually feels unpleasant, and that our society also teaches us that it's bad, it's only natural that we try to avoid or get rid of it. You may recall that this is known as experiential avoidance. In avoidance mode, we do whatever we can to get rid of or avoid unpleasant feelings. Common tactics we use include distraction, opting out, thinking strategies, and substance use. Let's quickly look at each of these methods. Distraction. We try hard to distract ourselves from our feelings through books, movies, computer games, TV, socializing, music, sports, exercise, crossword puzzles, cooking, cleaning, sex, gambling, sleeping, throwing ourselves into work, focusing on other people's problems, and so on. Opting out. Challenging situations give rise to uncomfortable feelings. So in order to avoid those feelings, we opt out of challenging situations. We quit, withdraw, procrastinate, escape, or stay away from people, places, events, situations, and activities that we find challenging. Thinking strategies. When we have unpleasant feelings, we often try to think our way out of them. Here are a few of the more common thinking strategies we use. Blaming others, analyzing why we feel this way, thinking about something more pleasant, denying that we're in pain, positive thinking, optimistic thinking, positive affirmations, challenging negative thoughts, fantasizing about the future, planning revenge, planning to escape, beating ourselves up, telling ourselves we shouldn't be feeling this way, telling ourselves to snap out of it, active problem solving, telling ourselves it's not fair, wondering, why me? Imagining, if only, rehashing the past, and so on. Substance use. We all put substances into our bodies at times in an attempt to get rid of unpleasant feelings and replace them with more pleasant ones. Which of the following do you use? Painkillers such as aspirin and acetaminophen, drinks such as tea or coffee, herbal or naturopathic remedies, prescription medications, alcohol, tobacco, marijuana or other illicit drugs, or foods such as chocolate, pizza, ice cream, hamburgers or chips. So what's the problem? At times we all operate in avoidance or autopilot mode, and this isn't always a problem. But the more habitual it becomes, and the more time we spend in these modes, the more problems they create. For example, the more I go through my day on autopilot, the less control I have. When fear and anxiety show up, they dictate my choices. I don't stop to consciously reflect on my options. I do whatever the fear tells me to do. If Albert Ellis had been operating on autopilot, he never would have spoken to those women. He would have let fear dictate his actions and steered clear of such challenging situations. What about avoidance mode? Well, any of those common methods for avoiding painful feelings, distraction, opting out, thinking strategies, and substance use can readily create problems. If we use them sparingly and wisely, these methods are fine. But if we use them excessively and rigidly, there will be many undesirable consequences. First, let's consider distraction. The more I invest my time and energy in doing things to distract myself from my feelings, the less time and energy I have to invest in the things that make life rich, full, and meaningful. Not to mention that some distractions, such as gambling or shopping, have big financial costs, and others, such as partying hard or working hard, can have big health costs over time. What about opting out? The more I use this as a strategy for avoiding fear, the smaller my life gets. I avoid taking risks. I avoid stepping out of my comfort zone. I avoid facing my challenges. I get stuck in a rut and miss out on all sorts of opportunities. One form of opting out is procrastination, putting it off until later. While this is fine at times, if I do it too much, important issues do not get dealt with, problems do not get resolved, and my to-do list grows bigger and bigger, which generates extra anxiety. When we over-rely on thinking strategies, there are many costs. A particularly big one is that we spend a lot of time in our heads instead of engaging in our lives. Others depend on the strategy used. Blaming others leads to relationship conflicts. Fantasizing about the future leads to discontent with the present. Beating ourselves up just makes us miserable. Positive thinking and challenging thoughts leads to frustration and disappointment when they don't have the desired effects. And if we over-rely on substance use, the costs to our physical health vary from addiction to lung cancer to obesity. But arguably the biggest cost of all is that the more we avoid our own fear, the bigger it grows and the more influence it has over our actions. We get stuck in the fear trap. The greater our efforts to get rid of fear, the greater our fear becomes and the more negatively it affects our lives. For example, Seb tried to avoid his fear of sexual failure by refusing to have sex with his wife. In the short term, this strategy helped him avoid his fear. But in the long term, his fear of failure just grew bigger, and he therefore became even more reluctant to have sex. By the time he sought help, he'd avoided making love to his wife for 4 years, and it had turned into a major source of conflict within their relationship. The fear trap. Have you ever heard the saying, "Get back on the horse"? Personally, I've never fallen from a horse, but I've been told it is pretty scary. Immediately after a big fall, most people would have some fear of getting back on, especially if they were injured when they fell. But the sooner you get back on and start riding again, the sooner you will regain your confidence. What happens if you don't remount the horse, if you put it off, week after week, saying, "I'll start again next week"? The longer you put off riding, the greater your fear grows. If you want to get back into horse riding, then you have to face your fear. You have to get back on the horse. Psychologists refer to this concept as exposure, and it has nothing to do with taking your clothes off in public. Exposure basically means staying in contact with whatever you're afraid of until you get used to it, and it has more positive impact on behavior than any other tool, technique, or strategy known to humankind. You've probably seen documentaries where people overcome their phobias. Let's say the subject is terrified of spiders. He panics whenever he sees one, and he won't go anywhere near them. He lives his life doing whatever he can to avoid spiders. He avoids looking at pictures of them. He closes his eyes if they appear in movies. He even tries to avoid talking about them. The problem is, the more he avoids anything to do with spiders, the more afraid of them he becomes. To get him over his fear, a psychologist exposes him to spiders in a gentle step-by-step program. First he looks at pictures of spiders, then he watches videos of spiders, then he looks at realistic toy spiders, then he looks at dead spiders in display cases, then he looks at living spiders crawling around inside glass jars. Eventually, he can even hold a living spider in his hand. Of course, most people wouldn't go quite that far unless they planned to get into spider breeding or something. This step-by-step approach is known as graded exposure, and you can see that it is the very opposite of avoidance. But suppose what we fear is not something outside us, like a horse, a spider, or a madman wielding an axe. Suppose what we fear is an emotion, feeling, or sensation. As long as we go through life trying hard to avoid that feeling, we will never overcome our fear of it. So here we come back around to experiential avoidance, the ongoing effort to avoid or get rid of unwanted thoughts and feelings. Experiential avoidance is like an emotional amplifier. It takes our fear and makes it bigger and bigger. And this then leads us to try even harder to avoid it, which makes it even bigger, and so on and so on. Thus, the more experientially avoidant we are, the more firmly stuck we are in the fear trap. So what is the alternative? Should we just grit our teeth, put up with the fear, and force ourselves to go through with it? Well, we could do that, but I wouldn't recommend it. There is another way of responding to fear that is radically different from almost everything our society encourages us to do. We don't put up with it or tolerate it. We don't suppress it or deny its existence. We don't distract ourselves from it. We don't try to talk ourselves out of it. We don't try to reduce it or eliminate it with self-hypnosis or other techniques. We don't try to make it go away with medication, herbal remedies, or food or alcohol. We don't try to pretend it's not there, the so-called fake it till you make it approach. So what do we do? All we need do is give it. Chapter 15, Plenty of Space. A bleak desert wasteland, populated by lost souls. Here there is no escape from the ravages of the scorching sun, the plagues of flies, and the ever-present threat of violence. Murder and mayhem, rape and revenge, torture and torment, these are not freak occurrences but parts of the daily routine for those who live here. If you've seen The Proposition, you'll know what I'm talking about. It is a grim and extremely violent western, brilliant but horrific, set in the Australian outback in 1880. It was filmed on location in the middle of summer, and the actors had to cope with blistering heat and huge swarms of flies constantly buzzing all around them. Now, obviously the actors couldn't keep waving the flies away, or they'd ruin all the shots. They had to let the flies crawl on their faces without reacting. This also made it more authentic. The historical advisers on the film believed that people in that era would have been so used to flies crawling all over them, they wouldn't have been constantly shooing them away. One of the lead actors in the film, Ray Winston, said he'd always wondered how those lions in wildlife documentaries seemed so oblivious to all the flies. However, after a few days of filming, he got used to them. Soon, he was able to let the flies be there without being bothered by them. He said, "They felt like feathers stroking my face." That's a pretty amazing attitude shift, isn't it? Under normal circumstances, we try as hard as we can to get rid of flies. We swipe at them, swat them, and spray them. We may install clever traps, put up screens, and do whatever we can to keep them out of our houses. And this is only natural. We know they are dirty and carry germs, and that if they contaminate our food, we can get sick. So, of course, we hate the idea of letting them crawl on us. And yet, when Ray Winston, diffused from all those thoughts and mindfully noticed the actual sensations of flies crawling on him, he discovered it was nowhere near as bad as he'd expected. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to let flies crawl on you, but I'd like you to consider this possibility. Suppose you could change your attitude toward your own fear in the same way Ray Winston did with the flies. Suppose you could diffuse from all those thoughts about how bad or unpleasant your fear is and how much you dislike it, and instead of trying to make it go away, you non-judgmentally noticed the physical sensations. If your mind is saying something like, "Why would I bother?" the answer is very simple. Trying to get rid of your fear takes up a lot of energy and is very distracting, like constantly trying to shoo away flies. It's hard to engage fully in your life while you're busy struggling with your feelings. Myth-busting time again. At this point, many of my clients start to protest, especially if they've been struggling with performance anxiety. They trot out the myth that high levels of anxiety impair performance and therefore it needs to be reduced. Unfortunately, this deeply held belief is not only regurgitated in many books on business and sports psychology, but also in many popular self-help books. Luckily, there's plenty of published research to show it's not true. For example, common sense suggests that if you feel less anxious during academic tests, then you'll perform better. But in 1988, psychologists A.R. Rich and D.K. Wolliver published some fascinating research that clearly showed this is not the case. They showed that when taking academic tests, most people have similar levels of anxiety, and what determines their performance is not their anxiety level, but their capacity for task-focused attention. In other words, if they could engage fully in the exam, instead of getting distracted by their own thoughts and feelings, they performed well, no matter how anxious they were. Other published studies in the fields of both athletic and sexual performance show similar results. You can find these studies by the psychologists D.H. Barlow, T.J. Bruce, S. Hanton, L. Hardy, G. Jones, and A.B.J. Swain, listed in the references section at the back of this book. Performance is not related to levels of anxiety, but to capacity for task-focused attention. Athletes and lovers who engage fully in the task perform best. Those who get distracted by their own thoughts and feelings perform worst. So when you put all your mindfulness skills together, when you unhook from unhelpful thoughts, make room for unpleasant feelings, and engage fully in the task you are doing, you will perform well, regardless of how anxious you are. Furthermore, the energy that you once spent on struggling with fear can now be invested in taking effective action. Engagement and expansion. In the previous chapter, I talked about the modes of avoidance and automatic pilot and how the more time we spend in these states, the more we amplify our fear and the greater the negative impact it has on our lives. In this chapter, we're going to look at two alternative modes, engagement and expansion. You're already familiar with engagement, being fully conscious, living in the present, making contact with the here and now, being fully aware of and connected with your experience. It is the very opposite of autopilot mode. Similarly, expansion is the opposite of avoidance mode. In expansion mode, rather than trying to get rid of unpleasant feelings, we open up and accommodate them. We make room for them and allow them to come and go in their own good time. It doesn't mean we like them, want them, or approve of them. We just stop investing our time and effort in fighting them. And the more space we can give those difficult feelings, the smaller their impact and influence on our lives. There's an ancient Indian tale that illustrates this point very well. An old Hindu master was fed up with the continual complaints and grumbles of his apprentice. So one day he asked the young man to fetch him a cup of water and a bowl of salt. When the young man returned, the master said, "Now, tip a handful of salt into the water." The apprentice did so. The master then swirled the water around in the cup until all the salt had dissolved. "Now taste it," he said to the apprentice. The apprentice took a sip and screwed up his face in disgust. "How does it taste?" asked the master. "Horrible," said the apprentice. The master chuckled. "Yes, very unpleasant," he said. "Now follow me." They walked down to the edge of a nearby lake, and the master said, "Now tip a handful of salt into the lake." The apprentice did so. The master said, "Now taste the water from the lake." The apprentice drank from the lake, and this time he smiled. "Not so hard to swallow, eh?" said the master. "This salt is like the inevitable pain of life. In both cases, the amount of salt is the same, but the smaller the container, the greater the bitterness. So when life gives us pain, instead of closing in around it, like this cup, we would do better to enlarge and open, like the lake." Lovely story, isn't it? But enough of the chit-chat. Now it's time to knuckle down and do it. Name your feelings. To handle any strong emotion effectively, we need to name it. NAME is an acronym that stands for N, notice, A, acknowledge, M, make space, E, expand awareness. We can use the NAME technique with any difficult emotion, feeling, or sensation, but for now we are going to focus solely on fear. Shortly I'll provide you with detailed instructions on how to do it, but first I'll briefly summarize the four different steps. Note, at first glance this exercise may seem long and complex, but you'll soon find it's much faster to do it than to read it. And with practice it gets quicker and easier. Indeed, once you know what you're doing, you can zip through the whole exercise in a few seconds. Step 1. Notice. Noticing, or paying attention, is at the very heart of mindfulness. Just as the first step in diffusion is to notice your thoughts, the first step in expansion is to notice your feelings. So when fear shows up in your body, notice where it is and what it feels like. Step 2. Acknowledge. Here we use simple self-talk to acknowledge that the feeling is present. We silently say to ourselves something like, I'm noticing fear, or here's a feeling of fear, or here's fear. These ways of speaking are unnatural, but they serve a purpose. They help us to separate from the feeling to some degree. Note the difference between here's fear and I'm afraid, or I'm noticing fear versus I'm scared. If we use a phrase such as I'm noticing or here's a feeling of, that helps us to remember we are not our feelings. Our feelings are transient events continually passing through us and changing like the weather. They do not define who we are or dictate what we do. Step 3. Make space. Here we breathe into the feeling, psychologically open up and make room for it. When we breathe deeply, it helps to anchor us in the present, and when we direct our breath into and around the feeling, it helps us to drop the struggle with it. The fear is still present, but the more space we give it, the less impact and influence it has on our behavior. Step 4. Expand awareness. Having created space for this feeling, we need to re-engage with the world around us. This last stage draws on our engagement skills. We continue to notice the feeling and simultaneously connect with the world around us. Okay, so that's the summary. Now I'll take you through it in detail. And if you'd like a voice to guide you, you'll find this exercise on Mindfulness Skills, Volume 1, available as a CD or MP3 from www.thehappinesstrap.com. Before we begin, you'll need to dredge up some fear so that you've got something to work with. So look back on your values-guided goals from Chapter 13 and find one that brings up fear. Now imagine yourself taking some sort of action toward this goal, sitting down to write that book, attending that interview, asking that person for a date, taking out that business loan, enrolling in that course, entering that tournament, going for that audition. Imagine it as vividly as you can. For example, as you take this action, what are you doing with your arms and legs? What can you see, hear, touch, taste, and smell? And as you imagine it, see if you can get in touch with your fear. If you can't tap into your fear merely by thinking about it, then another way is to make a firm commitment. What is one small step you will take today, and a larger step you will take tomorrow, that will get you moving toward your goal? Commit to this right now, and chances are fear will show up straight away. And if that still doesn't do the trick, then make your commitment publicly to someone you care about, in person, by phone, or by email. That's virtually guaranteed to rev up a fight-or-flight response. So please, do this now as best you can. Take as long as you need. Then, once you've tapped into some fear, let's name it and tame it. A quick reminder, NAME stands for notice, acknowledge, make space, and expand awareness. Now, bringing your fear with you so that we can work with it, let's get started. Notice. Many people feel fear most intensely in their throat, chest, or abdomen, but you might notice it in any part of your body. So take a few seconds to scan yourself from head to toe and notice all the different sensations of fear. What can you feel in your forehead, jaws, mouth, throat, neck, shoulders, arms, hands, chest, abdomen, pelvis, buttocks, legs, and feet? Now zoom in on the part of your body where the sensations are strongest. Remember, life is like a stage show, and on that stage are all your thoughts, all your feelings, and everything you can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. So shine a bright spotlight on this part of your body and observe the sensations as if you're a curious scientist. If your mind starts getting all worked up, "I hate this feeling, I can't stand feeling this way, I have to get rid of this feeling," just thank it for its comments or let it chatter away like a radio in the background. And the moment you realize you've been hooked, gently acknowledge it, unhook yourself, and refocus. Notice where the feeling starts and stops. Is it moving or still? Is it on the surface of your body or deep inside? If you drew an outline around it, what shape would it have? Notice the temperature. Is it all the same, or are there hot spots and cold spots? Notice the different elements within this feeling: pulsation, vibration, throbbing, pressure, temperature, and movement. Again and again, unhook yourself from your thoughts and refocus on those sensations under the spotlight. Observe them with curiosity, as if you were an archaeologist excavating a magnificent ancient temple. Notice every tiny detail. See if you can discover something new that you never previously noticed. Acknowledge. Now use a few words to acknowledge your feeling by name. Say to yourself, "I'm noticing fear," or "here's a feeling of fear," or "here's fear." And feel free to substitute other words such as nerves, stress, and anxiety. Make sure you do this non-judgmentally. Don't say, "Oh no, here's this horrible feeling again." And if you like, you can also remind yourself, "This is a normal feeling. This is what people feel when they face a challenge." Make space. Breathe slowly and deeply. First, breathe out. Push all the air out of your lungs, every last bit, until they are completely empty. Then pause for a second with your lungs empty, then allow them to fill slowly from the bottom up. Then once again, breathe out, slowly and steadily, completely emptying your lungs. Then as you breathe in, direct your breath into and around the feeling. Interpret this instruction any way you like, however you make sense of it is fine. Basically, in some way, sense or imagine your breath flowing into and around the feeling. As you breathe into the feeling, imagine that in some magical way, a vast space opens up inside you. Instead of closing down this feeling, trying to squash it or crush it, you open up and make room for it. You don't have to like, want, or approve of this feeling. You simply allow it to be there. If you like, you could say to yourself, "opening up, making room," or "let it be." Or you could use a longer phrase like, "I don't like it or want it, but I can make room for it." Keep those sensations under the spotlight, observing them with curiosity, and keep breathing into them. Open up little by little, progressively creating more space around the feeling. Remember, you're not trying to get rid of this feeling, you're simply making room for it. If you're somewhere private, one thing you can do that often helps is to gently place your hand over the sensations and notice the warmth flowing from your hand into your body. See if you can soften up or loosen up around the feeling. Imagine holding it gently in your hand as if it's a tiny baby or a rare butterfly or a fragile, priceless artwork. Do this for as long as required. Initially, it may take you a few minutes to really get that sense of making space, but with practice, you can do this in a few seconds. And if you're struggling with sensations in other parts of your body, then repeat the exercise there. Expand awareness. The final step is to expand awareness, so that as well as being aware of your feelings, you are also in touch with the world around you. In other words, you bring up the lights on the whole stage show. So keep that spotlight on the feeling and also start to bring up the lights on your body. Sit or stand up straight. Notice your arms, legs, head, neck, and shoulders. Have a stretch if you like. Be aware of your body and your fear simultaneously. Now also bring up the lights on the world around you. Remaining fully aware of your fear and your body, also notice what you can see, hear, touch, taste, and smell. This gives you an expansive awareness. Now you can see the whole stage show. Now you can engage in what you are doing. Remember Sarah, the dancer? Important values, she clarified in the domain of work, included creativity, courage, persistence, sensuality, connecting with her body, and skillfulness. Her short-term goal was to practice, 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 not only her dance skills, but her diffusion skills. Her medium-term goal was to attend more auditions, and her long-term goal was to land a place in a top dance company. When Sarah started attending those auditions, she was terrified. The fear welled up inside her, churning her stomach and squeezing away at her throat. But she practiced the name technique. She made room for the fear and engaged in her performance. And guess what? She wasn't offered a part at any of the next 5 auditions. But she didn't give up. She kept practicing her routines, she attended classes, and she even saved up for some private tuition. And all the while, she got better and better at diffusing from her thoughts of failure and making room for her fear. Finally, on her 6th audition, she landed a supporting role in a popular stage show. She hadn't yet achieved her long-term goal, but she was well on the way and living her values with each and every step of the journey. Troubleshooting expansion. If you've never done anything like this exercise before, you'll find it difficult at first. Like any other skill, it needs practice. So I hope you'll practice it several times a day. You can practice this with any difficult emotion, not just fear. Why not try it with anger, guilt, sadness, impatience, or frustration? You can make your practice sessions any length of time you like, from 30 seconds to 30 minutes. With practice, you can do this anytime, any place. In a meeting, on the sports field, in bed, at the office, during an argument, on the toilet, or in the shower. Indeed, it won't take long before you can run through all 4 steps in the space of just 1 deep breath. There are 5 main pitfalls to be aware of. 1. The hidden agenda. The purpose of expansion is to make room for difficult feelings, to accommodate them, not to evict them. So if you're practicing expansion hoping it will get rid of your fear, then you're still in avoidance mode, still trying to avoid or get rid of it. And as you've seen already, that won't work. You can't reverse hundreds of millions of years of evolution that have primed you to feel fear when facing a challenge. Trying to get rid of your fear will only amplify it. 2. The illusion of control. At times, you'll do this exercise and find that the fear rapidly disappears. When this happens, you'll feel a sense of relief or relaxation. At this point, it's easy to get hooked by the illusion that you've found a clever way to control your feelings, a method for avoiding your fear. But if you start using expansion for that purpose, then clearly you're back into avoidance mode. So if your fear disappears or reduces, then by all means enjoy it, but please don't come to expect it. Regard it as a lucky bonus. If you start to expect it, you'll soon be disappointed. 3. Getting hooked. It's easy for your mind to hook you with unhelpful stories, old favorites like, I can't do it, or it's too hard, or I don't have time, or harsh judgments like, I hate this feeling, or protests like, I just want to get rid of it. You can't keep those thoughts from showing up, so don't even try. Just let them come and go like passing cars. That's why we covered diffusion before expansion. If you're getting repeatedly hooked to such an extent that it interferes with expansion, then you'll need to do more work on your diffusion skills. 4. Tolerance. Sometimes people think expansion is about tolerating their fear, grinning and bearing it, putting up with it, or even resigning themselves to it. This is way off the mark. In expansion, we aim to allow our fear. And that doesn't mean we like it, want it, or approve of it. It simply means we give it space and allow it to do its own thing. To clarify this, imagine that you have an avoidance dial at the back of your mind. This dial goes from 0 to 10. When it's on 10, you're in total avoidance mode. You'll do whatever you possibly can to avoid or get rid of this feeling. When it's on zero, you don't like or want this feeling, but you invest absolutely no effort whatsoever in trying to get rid of it. When the dial is at zero, we call this acceptance. When the dial is set around five, we call it tolerance. Tolerance means you're moving in the direction of acceptance, but you're not there yet. If you sense that you're tolerating rather than accepting, that's okay. It's a good start. Just recognize there's more practice to be done. The experience of fully accepting a feeling, totally dropping the struggle with it, is very different from putting up with it. 5. Forgetting the point. We can easily forget the point of expansion, which is to make room for difficult feelings in order to live by our values. If we want to live rich and full lives, guided by our values, then we'll have to leave our comfort zones repeatedly. And each time we do, we'll feel fear. Expansion enables us to feel that fear without a struggle so that we can invest our energy in acting on our values. The next step. In this chapter, you've learned how to accept fear. Notice it, acknowledge it, make space for it, expand awareness. In the next chapter, you'll discover how to use your fear, how to turn it to your advantage. And you'll find it's a bit like... Chapter 16, Riding a Wild Stallion. You step onto the front porch of your farmhouse. You feel the warm caress of the morning sun. You stretch your arms wide and breathe in the fresh spring air. Then something on the horizon catches your eye, a shape in the distance, moving very quickly. You rub your eyes, not quite sure if you're dreaming, but no, it's real. You dash back inside, grab your binoculars, dash back out. Raise them to your eyes, and there it is, a magnificent beast, thundering across the plain, powerful muscles rippling beneath a coat of pure black hair. But it's not one of your own horses, it's a wild stallion, and somehow it has found its way onto your property. So what do you do? Fear is like a wild stallion. If we know how to harness its energy, we can use it to our advantage, but if we don't know how to handle it, we're in trouble. Imagine approaching a wild stallion without some good horse-wrangling skills. You'd get kicked, bitten, or trampled, and waste a lot of time and energy for no useful outcome. On the other hand, if you're a skilled horse whisperer, then you can approach that horse safely. And over time, if you treat it well, you can build a good relationship with it and eventually ride it. Now, I have to admit, I know absolutely nothing about handling horses, but I do know quite a lot about handling fear. So I'm going to show you how to become a fear whisperer. The ABC of fear whispering. There's a simple ABC formula for fear whispering. When fear shows up, we allow it, befriend it, and channel it. Allow it. Think of that wild stallion racing around. If you ever want to make use of its awesome strength, speed, and stamina, you first have to allow it to stay on your ranch. And the same goes for fear. There is a huge amount of energy within our fear. Remember, the fight-or-flight response evolved over hundreds of millions of years to prepare our bodies for action. Fear gives us sharpened reflexes, increased muscle tone, heightened awareness, and greater strength. It's like a potent fuel. But we'll never learn how to use that fuel if we're not willing to handle it. In the previous chapter, you learned how to allow your fear. You notice, acknowledge, and make space for it. After allowing, the next step is to befriend it. If you want to tame that wild horse, allowing it to stay on your ranch is not enough. You have to build a positive relationship with it. You have to win its trust. How do you do that? Well, from what I've seen in the movies, you approach it cautiously, talking softly and gently, getting closer and closer, and then you offer it some tasty food, and if it lets you, you stroke its flank. Keep talking calmly and soothingly, and show it that you're a friend, not a threat. Note, we do have to be careful when comparing horses with fear, because horses can seriously injure or even kill us. In contrast, fear is totally harmless. The worst it can do is make us feel very uncomfortable, but that aside, the comparison is useful. If we want to use our fear to our advantage, Allowing it isn't enough. We need to befriend it. Now, at this point, your mind may start protesting, but I don't like this feeling. Rest assured, you don't have to like it. Let's suppose there is a lonely old man in your neighborhood, and I offer to pay you $10 billion to befriend him. And let's suppose this man has some unusual habits. He is prone to angry outbursts of abusive comments, wears filthy clothes, and totally neglects his personal hygiene. So you really don't like him, and yet there's $10 billion at stake here. Would you make the effort to befriend him, even if you didn't like him? For $10 billion, I'm sure you would. So what about fear? If befriending it helps you to live by your values, achieve your goals, perform at your peak, develop genuine confidence, and generally live a richer, fuller, more meaningful life, then will you make the effort even though you don't like it? Befriending your fear is just like befriending a person or a horse. Friendliness involves being pleasant, welcoming, affectionate, trusting, collaborative, and helpful. Does this sound like a tall order? Maybe it is, but I encourage you to give it a try and see what happens. Be pleasant and welcoming to your fear. It may seem very weird, but try talking to it, making sure to keep a strong sense of humor. You might say, "Hello, fear. How thoughtful of you to drop by today. Come on in and make yourself at home. What do you want to do today? Oh, you want to give my heart a bit of a workout, do you? Please do be my guest. See how fast you can get it racing. Oh, you want to chase some butterflies around my stomach? Please, go for it. My house is your house." Obviously, you wouldn't do something like this in the middle of an interview or a performance because it would interfere with task-focused attention. But there are plenty of times and places where you could try this, such as in the car, in bed, waiting in line, during commercial breaks on TV, and so on. Be affectionate toward your fear. If you've got a good imagination, you could imagine shaking fear's hand, inviting it into your body and slipping your arm warmly around its back. And if you're somewhere private, then you could gently place a hand on the fear, that is, on the part of the body where you feel it most intensely, and hold it gently, letting it feel the soothing warmth of your hand. Be trusting toward your fear. It's not out to get you. Fear evolved for a purpose, to help us handle challenging situations effectively. It alerts us to risks and threats and readies us for action, should it be necessary. So, we'd be in big trouble if we didn't have any. Be collaborative with your fear. Recognize that you're playing on the same team. Don't fight with your fear. It's there to support you. It's a signal. It lets you know you're facing a challenge. So perhaps you could remind yourself, "This is my brain alerting me to a challenge. This is my body getting me ready for action." Regard it as a teammate, not an opponent. Be helpful toward your fear. Fear evolved to give you strength, speed, focus, and stamina. So help it to do its job. Help it to put its energy into something useful, something meaningful, something life-enhancing. In other words, channel it. Cast your mind back once more to that wild stallion. You've allowed it to stay and befriended it. Now what? Now you want to use it to your benefit, to saddle it up and ride it. And so it is with fear. You've allowed it, befriended it, now use it. Take a moment to notice how much energy it gives you, all that adrenaline flowing through your system. Your whole body is geared up for action. As I mentioned earlier, many successful athletes, business people, and stage performers don't use the word fear to describe those feelings they have when facing a challenge. They often talk instead of being revved, pumped, juiced, wired, or amped. These terms all acknowledge the energizing aspects of the fight-or-flight response. So ask yourself, how can I make use of all this energy? What values-guided activities can I channel it into? Of course, there are situations where you can't channel your fear into something useful. For example, if you're out on a first date, chatting away in a quiet bar or restaurant, there's not much you can do with all that energy. In such an instance, you just make room for it and engage fully in the present. However, there are plenty of times when you can make good use of your energy. For example, if you're playing sports, being physically active or giving some sort of performance, then you can channel all this fear energy into it. Reminding yourself to use your fear can make a huge difference at times. Over the past few years, I have been giving talks and workshops in Australia, the United States, and Europe to audiences varying in size from half a dozen to several thousand. Do I feel confident about doing this? Well, most of the time, yes, I do. I certainly didn't feel confident when I first started, but at this point I've had so much practice that I generally do. However, when I'm speaking on a new topic or running a brand new type of workshop, I definitely do not feel confident, nor do I expect to until I've done it over and over. But I do act with confidence. I get up on stage, give the speech or workshop, and engage fully in the task. Now here's the thing. Regardless of whether or not I feel confident, I always feel fear. If that surprises you, let me remind you of some basic human biology. When we're facing a genuine challenge, we're going to have a fight or flight response. So no matter how confident we are at doing something, if the situation is challenging, we'll feel fear. You may recall this rule. Rule 2. Genuine confidence is not the absence of fear. It is a transformed relationship with fear. Thus, before I start my talk or workshop, I make room for my fear, take a deep breath and say to myself, "Okay, here we go, let's put this energy into action." The fear is still there, but my relationship with it has transformed. Now it's not just something I need to make room for in order to get on with my life, now it's something useful in its own right. It's a potent fuel, a burst of energy that revs me up, gets me buzzing, and enhances my performance. And you can do the same thing in your life. Remind yourself regularly to channel your fear and notice the difference it makes when you do so. It may take a while to get the hang of this, but when you do, it makes a huge difference. Indeed, over time, you may find yourself using words like revved, pumped, and amped instead of fear and anxiety. And if there's nothing for you to channel your fear into, then make room for it and engage fully in whatever you are doing. Where to next? This brings us to the end of part 4 of the book. In the 5th and final part, we're going to tie it all together: values, goals, actions, diffusion, engagement, and expansion.